John Rivett interviewing Michael Rubner on Monday, September 22nd. In continuing and almost done with the project of interviewing past FGOs and administrators involved in the process. So thank you, Michael, for driving up from Florida for this interview.
You're welcome.
Very thoughtful of you. Did you enjoy the football game while you were up here?
Very much so.
Did you?
It was worth the trip.
So, what year were you born?
What year was I born?
Uh-huh, and where?
I was born in 1940 in Tel Aviv, Israel.
Okay.
Which was really Palestine, technically speaking.
Okay. And you came to the U.S.?
In 1956.
To go to school?
Well, that was one of the purposes. The family immigrated.
Okay. And where to?
We lived in Chicago,
okay.
Illinois.
And then why did you end up going to Berkeley? And was that for undergrad or grad school? I forget.
That was for the PhD.
Okay, where'd you go as an undergrad?
I went to, first 2 years I was in Wilson Community College, or junior college.
Where
in
was
Chicago.
That?
Yeah.
In Chicago?
Yeah. And then the last 2 years to get the bachelor's, I went to Rockford College, Rockford, Illinois, which I turned to co-ed school. It was the school that Jane Addams attended.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And getting her social work degree?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. Do they still have a legacy
there? It was an old women's seminary until about 19 mid-50s. And then I went there for the last 2 years, majoring in political science.
Oh, okay.
Then I went to Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to get my master's in political science.
When was that?
And then I went to, University of California. You asked me why California? Because Berkeley is... They offered me a teaching assistantship, and in my judgment, it was the top political science department in the country.
Okay.
And still is.
What year did you go? What year did you finish there?
Pardon?
What year did you start or finish
there? I started in 1964, the time to coincide with the free speech movement.
Uh-huh.
That was led by the late now Mario Savio.
Did you ever meet him or see
him?
Well,
I did not meet him personally, but I attended a lot of the rallies in front of Stroud Hall. And all of the rallies, there were the anti-war rallies during the Vietnam years. I finished there officially in 69 and then went to Israel to do my dissertation. And then went to, arrived here in East Lansing to take a job at James Madison College.
When did you
start? I didn't get the degree until 1975.
When did you start at James Madison?
On September, I can tell you exactly, it was in September of 1970.
Mm. And it was almost a brand new college.
Well, it was the start of this first senior year.
Okay.
So I did teach a senior seminar at that time, and I had the first really seniors. College was very small, under 300 students.
That wouldn't be the same senior seminar that you taught through your whole career, was it?
No.
Okay.
No, it was not. The curriculum was slightly different than it was later.
Okay. This isn't just about you, so I mean, I could keep going. This is a lot of fun, but. From that time until when you became the grievance official, did you have any involvement in the grievance procedure or in academic governance that sort of led you to eventually become the FGO?
Yes. Both at the college level and the university level. At the college level, I became involved and eventually elected to the Faculty Affairs Committee, or the FAC.
Mm-hmm.
And that committee is really, at that time at least, was a committee that was not only advisory to the dean on matters of curriculum and budget, but also tenure. It served as a kind of an omnibus committee.
Mm.
So I was involved in that respect. At the university level, and I have not reviewed my vita recently, so I'll rely on my increasingly defective memory. I was elected to represent the college in the university committee on faculty affairs, ACFA. and for several stints, really. Of course, not necessarily consecutive because of the limits, the term limits, but I was reelected several times and eventually became the chair of the University Committee on Faculty Affairs during one of the university's fiscal crises.
The sort of early 80s, must be.
Yes. I also served, if you want, some other committees that I served on. The University Committee on Faculty Tenure, I served one stint. And several ad hoc committees. We had a committee that was involved with Lyman Briggs to discuss questions of technology and, you know, possible curricular cooperation with them and collaboration. So there were several other committees of academic governance of various sorts. And in the 1980s, I don't remember exactly when, but this was during my tenure as chair of the committee, vacancy became available for the grievance position, faculty grievance official. And the University Committee on Faculty Affairs recommended me as their preferred candidate. And as it turned out, Cecil Mackey turned down that recommendation and chose somebody who was not recommended or did not rank higher than myself. It was an African American candidate. And I was disappointed. I think the University Committee on Faculty Affairs was disappointed. But in any event, when another vacancy became available, I applied again, and that time president was DiBiagio, and Scott was the provost, and I was interviewed, and I got the job and started in this office in 1989 and held the job for 15 years, longer than any other FGO.
Mm-hmm. Probably longer than anyone will ever do it.
It's possible, but records are set to be broken.
That one might not.
Might not.
Before you became FGO, what was your knowledge of the grievance official or grievances, or what did you see as the role of UCFA in terms of it?
Well, interestingly enough, I during the first maybe 7 years, excuse me, of my presence as a faculty member, long before even serving on UCFA, I was a member of a hearing panel. And
you remember which FGO?
Well, there was the Mary Lee Brady was the FGO. Okay. So I may have misspoken. It may have been in the 80s already when she was during her tenure. And I was really flabbergasted by her. She came in. She said a few. She literally read parts of the procedure and then just get up and left.
Wow.
And never stayed. And I remember the person who really took over was the presiding officer. I remember it was Frank Blatt of physics.
Okay.
And he's really the one who ran the show. And don't remember the particulars of the case. I think it involved the denial of tenure.
So that it was an important case.
It was an important case
For that person.
But I thought that the procedures. I wasn't clear about what the role of the FGL would be. But I thought it was strange that she left and never showed up again. I think Frank wrote up the report. And then we just came in to sign it, and that was it. And I never found out, of course, what happened in that particular case to our recommendation.
Did you have any other case you ever served as panel or presiding officer, or that was the one and only?
I never served as presiding officer.
Okay.
And because I was never really asked to. Of course, once I became chair of the UCFA, it would have been difficult to been a conflict of interest. My only other encounter was that as a member of UCFA, Mary, all I remember is that First of all, I don't remember her attending any of the committee meetings. And what I do remember is that there were a lot of concerns raised in several meetings about her incompetence. And so there was a lot of criticism. I don't remember...
In UCFA?
Yeah.
And this is during Dr. Banks' term as associate provost?
That's correct.
Okay. So when you were applying to become the FGO the second time, you were applying... Well, actually, she leaves and then Lash comes back for the second term of Lash LaRue.
Well, he was an interim appointment.
So, I mean, his second time.
That's correct.
But his interim time.
That's correct.
Both he and Bruce did two stints, one as FGO and one as acting or interim.
That's correct.
So you were kind of into, and maybe it's a good point to start, into a procedure that wasn't running as a smooth train, a smooth ship, however you want to phrase it. So
the thing that really struck me when I entered the office was the total number of cases that were left over from Brady's administration. I asked Lash and he showed me, and there were something like between, I'd say, 44 and 48 folders of in various stages of being processed. And I thought it was a huge number, but that was the legacy that was left. And also it wasn't sometimes clear why these cases were languishing in the office of the FGL.
Was there any transition from you to Lash, from Lash to you?
There was about a four-week transition, maybe 4 or 6 weeks, I don't recall exactly. And it was done intentionally so that he would be able to literally train me. And he did a fine job. He took me to introduce me to several officials. I literally was his alter ego. Even though he made decisions, which of course was his right to, he always consulted with me. He asked me if I had any questions and volunteered answers, and we established a very good working relationship within a short period of time.
Now, is it fair to say that Lash had assumed that what you and I would consider as the appropriate and traditional way the FGO attends hearings, the FGO is more actively involved in pulling together a hearing panel and working with them to edit reports, whatever, whatever. Lash was doing those sort of things?
Absolutely.
Okay. But Lash wasn't interim, and he was taking over with from an administration that wasn't as smooth. So what did you see as the major challenges? I mean, maybe you told me the major one, but I'm just curious.
The major challenge that I saw was to reduce the backlog of cases that we had. That was the biggest challenge. For me personally, it was also to learn the entire set of parameters of the job. I can tell you that right away when I took over on my own, when Lash's term terminated, one of my first challenges was to defend the authority of the FGO, because there were two administrators in the College of, one was osteopathic medicine and one in human medicine, where in one case the dean and in one case the chair simply put up a big fuss and refused to share requested information with me, and made the argument that I had no right to have access to that information. So there was one challenge right away, was to establish myself as a legitimate player, and to defend the integrity of the procedure itself by citing, by always going back to the document and saying, look, I have this authority, and you really ought to cooperate with me, because I'm I'm exercising, you know, authority that mm-hmm. is duly given to me by the university governance structure.
If you think of other big challenges, we can come back to them. But,
okay.
But
that was a big challenge.
In terms of that, one, what role did associate provost banks or what role did UCFA play?
Okay.
Or how did you use either of them in terms of that?
In that particular instance or in general?
You can go either way.
In that
Start
particular instance,
uh-huh.
See, I knew Bob from, and it was one of my, I suppose, advantages,
mm-hmm.
was that Bob and I go back to my very beginning here at James
mm-hmm.
Madison. He's the person who interviewed me for the job at James Madison.
Mm-hmm.
He was, at that time, associate dean and then became dean. So I knew Bob from my
mm-hmm.
days before he moved to the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt very comfortable. And when I was appointed FGO, it was clear that we would have a good working relationship, and he told me that if I had any difficulties, not to be reluctant to consult with him or to inform
mm-hmm.
him, and I did inform him. And but I also, I went to Office of Legal Affairs as well. I don't remember if it was at his suggestion or my own initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And insisted that they back me up in any kind of conflict over my right
mm-hmm.
under the FGP. And I did get administration support. It's no question that that information in both instances was supplied to me.
Okay. I wondered if your prior role with ACFA played any role, or how you utilized ACFA in the early days, or...
One of the first things that I decided to do when I met with Bob about the nature of the job, and he said that traditionally the UC that the FGO is welcome to attend the meetings, but that no FGO has attended regularly, and I think I'm the first FGO who attended each and every meeting
uh-huh.
Religiously.
That's my understanding from
yeah.
the interviewing other people.
Yeah. So every Tuesday, 1 to 3,
mm-hmm.
I was involved with the ACFA. What I did with ACFA essentially is, of course, I reported to them at the end of each term or each semester, and that was required. And I also brought to them difficult cases or instances where I needed to have either something in the FGP interpreted or I needed their backing.
Uh-huh.
And I received full support from ACFA. ACFA was always very, very important
mm-hmm.
to me. And I also used them as a sounding board on occasion. And I also brought to their attention problems that emerge that are not covered by any provision of the FGP.
Uh-huh. Could you give me an example?
Yeah, an example would be the absence of clear criteria for evaluation for annual salary adjustment
uh-huh.
in particular units or colleges
okay.
even. Yeah, I did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Staying on the same thing, if that's okay.
Sure.
Unless you want to. If one looks at the user's manual,
which did not exist before my administration.
Right. So you want to tell me a little bit about the
yeah.
history of the user's manual?
Yeah. As a result of, you know, discussions that I had with Bob Banks mainly, the idea came up. I don't remember whose, may have well been his idea. Let's give him credit perhaps for that. That we should have some kind of a manual that would be useful for everyone, for
mm-hmm.
for people who may want to know how to file a grievance, to people who are involved as presiding officers, as counsels, and as members of hearing panels. That would
mm-hmm.
be useful to have written something and so I sat down and over a period of time wrote it up, and then
mm-hmm.
ACFA did not vote on it, but they thought, they made suggestions, and maybe they did approve it officially. I don't know, does it say I don't remember if they voted on that formally or not, but they were aware of it, and I distributed the copies, of course. But one did not exist before him.
Mm-hmm. What one can get looking at it is that it first comes out in September 91, if there aren't any mistakes in,
okay, yeah,
in the cover.
No,
what then happens after in 92 through 2007, there are a couple after your time, are a series of UCLA interpretations, section 19.
Yes.
And so it doesn't appear that there's any that sort of says UCFA endorses this, but the first one appears to be on some kind of an issue or problem. So it's up to you how much particulars you want to get into or not. But if you want to just summarize the point behind these interpretations, that would be helpful. Or
well, these are examples of issues that were not clear from the procedure itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they emerged during my tenure as I mm-hmm. tried to be fair to everyone. And there were these, lacuna, I would call them. There were just areas that were not covered
mm-hmm.
or that were not clear. And so I went mm-hmm. and I said, would you, it's your job really to interpret the FGP. And consequently, they did,
mm-hmm.
and I participated in making suggestions as to what I thought would be a fair interpretation,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes they accepted that view, and sometimes they modified it, and one of them was we didn't know when appeal panels, what is the time frame for appeal panels to submit their reports.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that was really a deficiency in the document.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they said within 14 days, and we did that. There were problems also with the failure of the president to respond in a timely manner
uh-huh.
to you know, and forward his decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That was primarily during, I think it was McPherson's tenure as president. I don't think we had any problem with DiBiagio, if I recall, but it was McPherson primarily. They set sometimes longer than 30 days.
Uh-huh.
And that's why we passed and interpreted Section 538.
Mm-hmm.
You can go back to 538 and see what 538 said at the time
mm-hmm.
and how this was modified.
I can pull those out if you want.
Yeah, there was one, when a recommendation is overruled, in whole or in part, written reasons shall be given. That's one of the things that happened was that when we did receive it within 30 days, there was a tendency in some instances for the president not to explain mm-hmm. the reason for modifying or reversing mm-hmm. or rejecting, and so we wanted something in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then the other, of course, I'll take this back what I said. 538 had all of that in there. I think the major problem that this particular interpretation intended to do
mm-hmm.
was to, we had instances where losing parties communicated with the president to try to influence his decisions,
uh-huh.
Or with somebody that knew the president. And we insisted, and ACFA agreed to imply that the parties or the representatives may not initiate communication with the president concerning the grievance.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of instances where counsels who were deans or mm-hmm. administrators who had access to the president and the president's office would try to influence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 538. So
mm-hmm.
take back what I said before.
Mm-hmm.
See, I haven't looked at this in several years. So
sorry, I'm making you.
No, that's all right. So the underlined sections here that interpret were sections that were in there.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much complied.
Mm-hmm.
But we used those sections that were explicit to deal with issues that emerge.
Mm-hmm.
We had instances where lower level either deans or chairs
mm-hmm.
would not respond and make a decision within 14 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the interpretations was that if there's no communication from that administrator,
mm-hmm.
Either in terms of rendering a decision or asking for an extension of 14 days,
mm-hmm.
That if we don't hear, that would mean that the recommendation of the panel stands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then, of course, the question was, what should the FGO do at that time? And the UCFA agreed that in that case, the FGO will initiate an appeal procedure on behalf of the party or parties against whom a negative judgment was rendered
mm-hmm.
by the hearing panel. Unless that party informs the FGO that they really didn't want to appeal. But we wanted to make sure that the rights of the losing party, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
would be protected in those instances because
mm-hmm.
no decision had been rendered by the administrator. So those are the things that
mm-hmm.
emerged in the course of administering the FGP,
mm-hmm.
in which there was really silence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that in your capacity as FGO, you ran into those things. Constantly on a day-to-day basis, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're just things that the FGP did not anticipate, and those issues,
I think if you keep going through that, if you start getting to the ones that are sort of late 90s, they kind of...
The late 90s, yeah. Beginning with G.
They start being, in terms of these frequent filers, a couple of people who brought a lot of business to the office and maybe had you more frequently going to UCFA for advice, either in interpretation or backing up your authority in terms of keeping the system working properly, or how would you phrase looking back? There's about four or five letters that relate to them.
Those emerged as a result of two or three individuals who really occupied most of my time in, I'd say, the last 5 years or so
mm-hmm.
of my administration, really.
Mm-hmm.
One of them accounting, both of them accounting for the bulk of the cases that I,
mm-hmm.
and you can see from the interpretations what the problems were. One of them was that the one of the individuals would simply go public.
Mm-hmm.
And not respect confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to iterate all the time that confidentiality is really of the utmost importance.
Before his doing that, it really hadn't been very often that it was an issue?
It was never an issue.
Never an issue?
Never an issue.
Okay.
Faculty and administrators involved in these cases really respected confidentiality and... we really did not run into the cases. A lot of people weren't even aware that there is a grievance procedure, let alone that there are winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not an issue. It was not an issue.
Okay.
But it did become an issue
mm-hmm.
at that time,
mm-hmm.
in the 1990s, early 2000, yeah. Yeah. These are all confidential. Well, not
there are variations on that, but
that's right.
Yeah.
And then there were questions of submission of documentation and
uh-huh.
the load that was imposed on our office. I mean, one of the grievance, submitted 300-400 pages of material,
mm-hmm.
and to reproduce that for
mm-hmm.
hearing panel, presiding officer, counsel, the other counsel. You know what it
mm-hmm.
runs to. And this was at a time when our budget was, of course, limited.
Mm-hmm.
So we put a limit, recommended a limit, or set a limit of 200 pages that would be reproduced, which was already a lot more than anybody would have wanted, certainly unprecedented during my tenure. I think those individuals, between you and me, tried to use the procedure to just make it impossible to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
They were less interested in resolving cases than to just make everybody's life on campus miserable.
if I can get off of them, unless you want to say more about them.
No, but that's the context of
right.
these interpretations.
Right.
About.
You just mentioned about budget limitations of the office. You want to say anything more in terms of your sense of what budgeting was for this office? Or you used the word limitations. I don't know if that was in reference to certain kinds of problems or issues that you had.
I was constantly aware that we need to be vigilant about the way in which we spend the money that was available to us. We never really received huge increases in the budget. If there were modifications, they were always from the base of the preceding year, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also thought that the workload on my secretary had to be taken into account as well. And it wasn't only budgetary concerns, but also the workload. We did not have a student assistant who would be able to really do all of the
mm-hmm.
technical work that was
mm-hmm.
needed for hearings. So there was a combination of factors.
Okay.
Just the physical management
mm-hmm.
of the documentation
okay.
was becoming a monumental task.
Mm-hmm. I'll switch off of that unless you want to
okay,
comment
just,
on something. You're looking
I'm
at one
curious.
Of the ones. You're curious about the last ones?
Yeah, I noticed that there is that there's at least one that came after I left office.
Yeah, I think two.
Or maybe two. That could very well be.
One comes specifically out of one of your recommendations
okay.
in a document that you wrote to
yeah. okay, I
leadership.
See. Yeah.
But then I
right.
pursued
right.
in the 14 days for somebody who wants
sure.
to play with panel challenging and make the hearing not happen.
I understand.
That's that one.
Right. Yeah.
I can't remember what the other
sure.
one is off the top of my head.
Okay. But you can see that this has a quite a history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as a result of this, the procedure became much more streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
And I think development individuals have made very good use of this manual. I do not know how often during hearings, panels, and presiding officers were able to make references to that. And it also lays out the way in which hearings ought to be conducted, so.
The interview isn't of me, but I could tell you a couple quick things. One is that I regularly use it in terms of training new presiding officers, new counsels. It's extremely helpful
yeah.
in that manner.
Yeah.
I usually, unless somebody's an old hand as a presiding officer, have a short meeting with them before, the day before or something, after they've seen the material and run through and explicitly run through the conduct of a hearing so that they're, again, familiar with the exact things they need to say and do.
Sure.
And it's very helpful there. It's very helpful for counsel. It's very helpful for grievance or administrators when you get close to the hearing, and so I've made full use of it. There is an interesting thing, and I'll be brief about it. Talk later about this potential revisions of the grievance procedure. One of the triggers of thinking that there was a need for some revision related to some conflicts that the I'll name the legal office, but not in a negative way. But there were some instances where their administrators or legal office were saying, "What you're doing is what it says in the user manual, not what it says in the grievance procedure."
And there was conflict between the.
There are a couple areas that sort of aren't identical. That in spelling out how to handle something, you've spelled it out beyond what, and so the couple areas are, one of them is about information rights, which you mentioned already. There haven't been big issues, but I did have one administrator and one legal counsel refuse to provide information. Other than that, the associate provost or the provost have always been very clear, and the legal office has been very clear, but one person went in a different direction. I don't think it'll happen again. but kind of gave advice saying, no, you don't need to. And that's...
I'm not clear. I think that when it comes to inflammation, the power of the FGO is unlimited.
It's unlimited to ask. It really doesn't give any authority. It doesn't say they have to provide.
The power to ask and not to provide, the power becomes meaningless.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And this became, this, as I say, in the end, the associate provost and provost were supportive, but one legal counselor provided different advice to an administrator who did not want to provide information. And that's part of it. It then spun into a different issue, which
but
was...
But I'm still not clear where the...
Let me go to the different issue, okay. See if it clarifies. The issue then gets more complicated when you're dealing with appeals. And the grievance procedure has a very clear line about appeals hearing, which is a little different than what it says in the user's manual. And the procedure itself says, appeals shall be decided upon the record of the original proceeding and upon argument of the parties presented to the appeals panel. And that clause was used to say, and no other information can be brought forward, so why does anybody even have a right to ask for any other documents when the appeals hearing should only include the record of the original proceeding? Your clarification in the user's manual is to say that's general policy, but there are reasons sometimes why we might allow, or a panel might allow, at a hearing to bring in some other things. But the exact words don't say that. It just says the other. So that became an issue that, quite frankly, we kind of resolved for that instance, and then kind of the provost office and the council office said, that won't be our general policy, but that did happen. And that was one of a couple instances where it was brought up, sort of the user's manual giving helpful information was adding to the exact words that were in there. And so somebody was deciding to be a stickler as an attorney, and or really what happened is an administrator didn't want to give it, and they found somebody in the legal office wasn't usually involved in this to support him in that. So that was one of a couple examples where that kind of issue arose. But as I was saying, it's been very helpful, useful. I still use it. I have a whole routine of what I sort of do, both in preparing the POs and councils, but also a set, so I'll say the same thing to every panel before turning it over for what they do to remind them and let them know things like, and again, quite frankly, it's stuff that isn't in the grievance procedure. That is, you don't have to have a unanimous decision. You can have a split decision. You can have a minority report. If the panel isn't told that, they wouldn't know that in deliberation, right. Which is why there's certain things I pull out the same user's guide that I've marked up, so I'm telling every panel fairly the same information before telling the presiding officer, let him know, start talking.
Sure.
But that isn't in the procedure. Yeah. And so anyways, there's several examples of that, and that was one of the kind of triggers. Another, quite frankly, is there are words that were appropriate to the university 36 years ago that aren't the same today. And I think I mentioned to you some units have come up with new titles, like, to me, the funniest one is professor in residence.
Okay.
And professor in practice.
Okay.
Not titles that we have in the procedure, because they didn't exist. Quite frankly, a unit sort of made it up for its own purpose, and that person might even actually be an academic specialist when you look into it. But there have been a series of things that we sort of sparked in. Before talking about the specifics, I want to ask you a couple other things. But one of the things that I found interesting in thinking about this possible revisions was to go back to the history of the procedure and to look back at the actual interim procedure passed in May 72,
mm-hmm.
which you handed over to me as part of files of old business.
Okay.
I have two questions about that. One is, did you ever have much need to ever look back at this, or you just looked at the document that you inherited, which had had a few changes?
I almost never recall, I don't recall going back to this at all.
Okay. Partly it's just kind of interesting as a historical thing. UCFA is a different name in the old days and stuff. But I was trying to figure out on a couple of these issues for revisions, why do we do things a certain way? One of the ones that was sort of, I can't answer that, and I can't find anybody who does. Why 72 hours? That is, the grievance procedure has the 72 hours for the point where parties will receive the documents and panel will receive the documents and presiding officer will receive the documents 72 hours before a hearing is held. A kind of a curious number.
At least 72 hours.
Uh-huh.
The idea was to allow, I understood the 72 was sufficient time.
Okay.
For the other side, and not only the other side, but for the panel and their counsel, the counsel on both sides.
Okay.
Especially on the other side. To go through the material so that it would be sufficiently prepared for the hearing. I believe that the thinking was that if you give them, I mean, sometimes it was more than 72
okay.
hours if we had it earlier, but we wanted to make sure it's not last minute.
Okay.
Because if you did not set any limit at all, then people would come in to a hearing and then get the material. So you wanted to avoid at least that possibility, and the thinking was also
okay.
that if you made it longer, that people would not read it at all.
Okay.
Because it would sit on faculty's desks.
Okay.
So I think 72 was a compromise.
Okay.
A reasonable compromise.
Okay. It appeared to me that that's what the old original document said.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the people who are involved in the procedure no longer find that a reasonable compromise. They find it way too short.
That could be. It depends really on the amount of material that the one needs to...
Yeah. It also relates to, I think, the job of faculty has changed and more people come and go more than they used to probably. And,
come and go...
take off on research trips. For a couple days here or there, different sort of things, and so
right.
people are sort of saying 72 hours isn't sufficient, and so one of the compromises that's being floated is to give it a week. But what you just said is useful kind of perspective. What I was kind of curious was, that was, for me, one of the things that looks like it goes way back to 71, 72, and it always sort of stays the same.
I think because it worked.
Yeah. Okay. And so here's my more broad question to you. Were there certain things that ever came up for you? I know you went to ACFA for interpretation. You went to ACFA and to the associate provost for support, to get information, to get support that integrity of the office, as you so well described earlier. Did you ever think about asking for revisions in the grievance procedure itself, and what happened to those ideas?
I would need to go back to the records
okay.
to be honest with you.
But that did come up sometimes.
Well, when there were at least a couple of occasions where, as a result of discussions that I had with Bob Banks
uh-huh.
Or with the Office of Legal Counsel, and it wasn't during Kurtz's administration, but Bob Nono, where there was a decision made that you really need to revise the FQP, and
uh-huh.
you have the dates when the FQP was revised.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I worked very closely with the office of with Bob Banks
mm-hmm.
and with Noto and with
mm-hmm.
UCFA to either clarify things or modify them and amend them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes some of the initiative came from me, but I think the main impetus did not come from me.
Okay.
But you have the date specifically when these things were amended, or at least discussed.
I don't have it in front of me, so I want to switch to a slightly different question or comment, if it's okay. Were there ever any times where you looked for ACFA to interpret the FGP and be able to add another interpretation to the user's manual that they didn't go agree with you?
Yes.
Okay. You willing to talk about that?
Do I remember, though? There were instances, not many, but there were instances.
I guess I've heard of one.
Tell me and tell you, refresh my memory.
The two frequent filers were getting so many cases.
The number of times that somebody can file a grievance within a certain amount of time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I made suggestions. I don't remember the specifics.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to limit. Because same individual had about 14 or 15 cases at the same time. And ACFA resisted that. They sympathized with the plight of the FGO.
Mm-hmm.
Almost to a person. But they believed that it would not be prudent to limit access.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that was a clear attempt on my part to make things a little bit more manageable and also to really respond to one of the arguments about them was we're responding to a specific case, a specific individual.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument was that this specific individual can ruin the whole procedure or at least put a dent in it. But my arguments fell well. I don't want to say deaf ears, that they were not deaf ears,
right.
But they were not responsive to.
That, quite frankly, was the main one that I knew of.
Yeah, that was the most, and it was more than one occasion that I brought it.
But, I mean, I
actually. Yeah. That was really maybe the only one that that they literally turned me down. There were others, I'm sure, that were modified.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Switching to a slightly different topic, here's the pile of all of the annual reports for this office since the beginning. I don't know when's the last time you would have looked at these, but I assume it's a few years ago.
Yeah.
The very first one, done by Michael Harrison, is sort of a narrative about the few cases that exist. Then starting with the second one, which is Bruce Miller, it becomes a little bit more of a count. And then sort of following, while starting with some of yours, say in 1991, I just grabbed that, you changed it a little. It basically stays pretty much the same, and I've pretty much kept it the same with a few modifications too.
Stays the same what?
The format and the
well,
issues.
I changed the format. I believe I've changed it all the time. And I wanted to provide a quick bird's eye view of the statistics so that they get an idea of the workload. And then I used it also to describe in prose, to elaborate, so that they have a context for interpreting the statistics.
I actually see that. When I grabbed the last one of Lashes, there's no narrative.
That's right. Well, in part, I think it has to do with the interim appointment itself.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't going to spend more time than is necessary. So that was notice how many cases he resolved informally. 58. I mean, a huge number that he inherited.
58?
Yeah,
probably 58. That's
and then there was
the year
88, 89. Yeah. If you can also see that I informally in 1991, which is my second or third year, resolved informally 48.
Mm-hmm.
So you can literally see what happened. I also, if you
here's
notice,
actually your first one, Michael, 89, 90.
Okay. And you can see that This is an annual report, so we had 40. Still, large number. And you notice with the passage of time, I think you can do an analysis of my reports. Their reports become more elaborate, I think.
Uh-huh.
New categories are added. And some of them contain also suggestions for change. You can go through some of them, I think, contain suggestions for change or identify issues for UCFA to consider,
uh-huh.
right? So you can see that we also added categories. That inquiries became a new category.
Okay.
I don't think it was a category before. I also provide as much more information about how grievances were being disposed. And I also summarize various initiatives that I took in addition to just regular activities.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reports, I don't want to pat myself on the shoulder, but I think that during my administration, the reports were more informative than my predecessors.
Uh-huh.
I think they're longer, they provide more information,
mm-hmm.
both statistically as well as the in prose.
Now, was that, they had existed, making them more elaborate was sort of something you just thought was necessary?
Absolutely.
Okay. Based on what?
Absolutely. I think they were useful for Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
They were distributed, of course, to Academic Council. I don't think they made much impact on Academic Council at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's required to provide them to Academic Council, and the Office of Academic Governance did that, as we all know, as a matter of routine. But I think people get so many documents on Academic Council that
mm-hmm.
They seldom became issues of discussion in Academic Council or inquiry in Academic Council and so forth.
It's interesting, they kind of come and go. Bruce Miller's are more similar in terms of the amount of narrative
mm-hmm.
that there is.
Yeah.
Did you ever chart out multiple years, like for your five-year review?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe that there are two of those. You
okay.
may check. I think so.
It's not in this pile, but I'll look elsewhere.
I think so. For my fifth year review, and then for my 10th year review, yeah. They were not very long because they were a compilation of previous reports.
Mm-hmm.
So they were more statistically oriented.
This one is in terms of the evaluation. This is one of the five-year reviews, but it's more about the evaluation of.
That was not done by me.
Okay.
That was a summary done by ACFA.
That's ACFA. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And it only covers the survey. It doesn't cover annual reports.
Well, I think they may have made references inside to that.
Okay.
Yeah. They found it useful, but they also had instituted, of course, the questionnaire that they sent out to, and they knew who
mm-hmm.
to send it out on the basis of talking to, or having our secretary
mm-hmm.
send out the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't include the other kinds of numbers.
Are there other things you want to discuss about the grievance procedure, its history, or your term as being the FGO?
No, other than to say that I can tell you that my decision to retire was in part prompted by these two faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
Who literally made my life as FGO just absolutely miserable.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have reconsidered that without had the circumstances been different.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I would say. I would also say that it was difficult while during those 15 years as FGL to really engage in any sustained large-scale research effort.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that one could not do writing. I did do writing,
mm-hmm.
and I did publish. But you really couldn't do much in terms of, at least I found it very difficult, for example, to assemble enough material and to engage myself continuously so that I could, for example, produce a book.
Mm-hmm.
I found that difficult. I would also say that some individuals, because they were able to establish an amiable personal relationship with the FGL,
mm-hmm.
Began to abuse the system in a way by coming in with, making excessive demands on the FGL's time.
Mm-hmm.
It was restricted maybe to half a dozen individuals, but it became really difficult to tell them, you know, you're really, you're just coming in to talk to vent, and I can't, it's the same old stuff, I can't really do anything about it, you know exactly what you need to do, but in fact what they were doing is
mm-hmm.
exploiting a friendly personal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I found that frustrating because you couldn't really tell these people to bug off unless you were willing to risk rupture in a personal relationship. I found that difficult.
I did do that.
Okay, well that's...
It ruptured it.
Okay.
And it also led to a humdinger of a paragraph and survey evaluation of the FGO who would...
Well, there's a cost.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always a cost. Right. But
I thought it was bordering on sort of clinical social work.
Yeah.
And I said that's not
right.
what this office is about to
right.
provost and talk, but explain
right.
what...
One of the more frustrating... aspects of the job, and I'm sure that you may have encountered something like that, is when you spend a lot of time working out a reasonable solution to a problem,
mm-hmm.
and then the grievant, for reasons that you cannot always determine,
mm-hmm.
Turns you down, and tells you it's the principle, and you know that's not the principle because the person has no principles at all.
Very funny.
Pardon?
I said you're very funny.
But it's true.
Fortunately, that hasn't happened to me too much in four years.
That's good.
It has happened, but...
Yeah. I mean, I've had people, I'll be honest with you, I'm not going to mention names, I don't even remember names, but people making 100,000 or 150,000
uh-huh.
and arguing over $275.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at least one specific case like that, and I said
mm-hmm.
to myself, this is absolutely insane.
I had one like that, and the person may have actually had a good case, but they could get no sympathy from the panel
mm-hmm.
because their salary was better than
sure.
almost all of theirs or all of theirs. And
sure.
And it just seemed like such a small amount.
Right.
But
right.
the person did feel it was the principal, and they weren't offered a settlement
right.
there. But I know what you're talking about in terms of... But
one other part that you asked me is that in the beginning I was more prone to write the reports myself
mm-hmm.
because presiding officers and panels were just moving too slowly or reluctant
mm-hmm.
to take the initiative or because the writing was so sloppy that I felt embarrassed to submit it
mm-hmm.
even though it was not my work. So very often. Often, I'd say,
mm-hmm.
I would take the initiative, invite it, but with the passage of time, I decided that this is not really the FGO's job,
mm-hmm.
the job should be done. But I did find myself spending an inordinate amount of time editing, because the writing of some people is just awful. And I'm a stickler for, you know, at least clear, concise, accurate, grammatically accurate communication, and spent an awful lot of time doing that.
That part didn't change, and my way of looking at it is, quite frankly, many of these people can write. Some can, but many of them can. But they don't own these reports. Only the FGO owns the report.
That's right.
It's only the FGO who's going to sort of care, because it's the FGO who the same provost or the same president or the same people in the general counsel office are going to be reading them and have a sense of. So, but I have never written a report.
Sure.
I have edited, though, many of them more than one round. So.
Right. Let me ask you, how much longer do you want to go?
I think we're about done.
Oh, okay. Do you want to go out for lunch or do you?
I don't know what time we got to be.
It's noon. It's about 5 after 12.
We can go to lunch. I need to be done by 1:15, though.
Okay.
So, was there anything else you want to say? Any positives? Do you help some people?
Oh, of course. I can say a lot of positives.
Well, say some positives.
I'll say a lot of positives. I think I made a difference in the lives of many individuals who sometimes had lost, hope that the university would be responsive to their concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So in a practical, pragmatic way, we helped to a lot of people. And I know that because to this day, I hear from people coming back and saying, I don't know what I would have done without your office or without your help. Without the procedure.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know a lot of people on campus that I never had met, and including people that became personal friends, regardless of the outcome of the specific case. I got to know a lot of administrators and learned appreciation for the point of view of administrators and the constraints and resources with which they operate. I was another very, very important positive was that I was able to manage my time much more independently and autonomously. Another positive was the way in which I was able to get the support of upper level administrators for the most part, not always. As you know, I had a run-in with the interim president, or with president. I don't remember if he was interim or full head. No, I had a title of president. And he ordered me to cease and desist.
Cecil?
No, it wasn't Cecil. It was...
DiBiagio?
No, the other one. In between DiBiagio and McPherson.
No.
His son is in ag. He was the natural resources at the state level.
Gordon Geyer.
Yes, Gordon Geyer. Tried
taking me a second.
Of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And running with him. So, for the most part, my relationship with the administration was good.
I don't know who is it. I've never asked him that question. I don't know who he got that advice from.
Would he tell me?
I don't know.
Okay. So anyway, there were a lot of positives, of course I got to know the way in which the university runs itself, the most important thing was really to help individuals. There were some people who literally... There was one instance where somebody came in and told me that they had only a few months to live.
Uh-huh.
There were two people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed advice. They didn't have grievances. They just needed advice. And so I think I helped them in a personal way by making suggestions and also listening. And so in that way, that was the most rewarding part of the job, was to know that you did your best and that you treated people fairly no matter what the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very rewarding. And also to be able to get the very positive evaluations of colleagues from ACFA. I always have, you can read the reports, you can read the evaluations, and you have copies of them. They appreciated, ACFA appreciated, and the administration appreciated what you were doing. And that was important. There were some people, of course, who did not, and they criticized them and gave me a bad name. You know that. There were campaigns, personal campaigns, and all of that. There was no frustrating part of it.
I grabbed an old release form, but still I need to have use a release form. It's an old one that's about when I was interviewing union leaders, but it's the same business that I give eventually the tapes to the university voice library. Found Mary Brady to interview her.
She's still alive?
I think somebody told me yes when I asked that. And
you know, Betty has been extremely ill.
I heard that. Somebody told me.
Do you know what she what she's now still?
Bob or Deb mentioned it, and I can't remember which one. We can ask Deb.
Well, she's out now. Today's 9/22/08
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
Yeah.